You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 309, is Theresa May running the worst election campaign in living memory? And was she right to swerve the television debate? Now, other televised sports employ some outstanding experts, so why can't football even find competent co-commentators? And you don't have to be ancient to believe things ain't what they used to be. Oh, thank goodness. It's all coming up after Talking Heads and Life During Wartime.
Marvellous apocalyptic funk, a lead single from the 1979 album Fear of Music, Talking Heads and Life During Wartime.
I'm quite enjoying apocalyptic funk as a kind of as a band name, really. It makes me think of Les McQueen from the League of Gentlemen. That would have been one of his later outfits, surely.
Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 309. I'm Terence Stackham, and, well, East Coast girls are hip. I really dig those styles they wear. But I prefer South Coast girls like Juliet Harris.
Ah, you know, as ever, you're far too kind. I wish we all could be St. Leonard's girls, etc.
Exactly, yeah. Jules, when Theresa May called the snap election on the 18th of April, she did so with the confidence of someone who felt it was simply a question of how enormous a Conservative majority would inevitably follow. You and I felt the same and made predictions of the size of the Tory majority. We were quite circumspect. As some polls at the outset were suggesting Mrs May's Conservatives would stroll into Parliament with a huge three-figure majority. Now, since then, Mrs May and her team seem to have made one blunder after another, with opinion polls now suggesting that it's possible the Conservatives may not even win the election at all. This leads me to my opening question, which is, how have the Conservatives managed to run the worst election campaign in living memory?
Well, this is a fair question, isn't it? It's firstly, I can't believe she only called it at the end on the 18th of April.
Forever,
because
doesn't it just fit
well? I mean, to be fair, it's been dispiriting and tedious in different ways than we thought it initially would be. In that, at the beginning, we just thought it would be a non-event of a campaign, and you know that she would, you know, she'd win by miles, and it was all a bit boring, really. And now it seems to be that everybody's really quite useless. That seems to be the latest kind of conclusion of it. I I think the problem is, well, I've said previously that Theresa May was holding the parcel when the music stopped, and that to some extent was for her credit. It would seem, I think, she's quite clearly realising that she's bitten off far more than she can chew. I don't think Theresa May and David Davis running Brexit is going to work. I think if she does win, I think there's going to have to be, you know, forget the political games of let's have the Brexiteers in charge when it all goes wrong. Because guess what? When you're a female prime minister, it all lands on you. So I think there's probably going to be quite a significant cabinet reshuffle. My dear friend Amber Rudd, my MP, I suspect is probably going to end up being Chancellor or something else.
If she keeps her seat, there's even a suggestion.
I'm going to pour some cold water scepticism on that. I had to spend all of last night doing that in a very gentle way to very overexcited people at a social event I went to. So, okay, so we can talk about the polls. Firstly, to deal with your point about the campaign. Theresa May is a controller. That's what she's like. That's her style. That's what she was like at the Home Office. The Home Office famously fell out with people. Fiona Hill had to go because she'd fallen out with I think it was Gove's lot, wasn't
it?
Who in turn fell out with everyone else. I'm not saying there's much between any of them, really. But she's a controller. To the extent where the main problem has been the manifesto, or rather not the manifesto itself, although I do think the social care thing was badly done, but it was the big mistake was you turning on it, because the whole point was she was meant to be, lest we say it, strong and stable, and she was meant to be, you know, the Iron Lady, obviously. There have been so many attempts to draw comparisons with Thatcher, and this idea that, you know, she's the tough woman that's going to go into Brexit and she's going to fight for it and she's going to be there when the going gets tough, the Billy Ocean of the political world. Guess what? When the first sign of trouble, and oh no, we're just going to clarify this. No, you're not clarifying, you're just saying you're not going to do it. And the way that that happened in the manifesto was that Nick Timothy, so Theresa May has her two kind of main chiefs of staff, Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy. Nick Timothy, who, by the way, someone put a picture of him up on the internet the other day and said, how on earth is this man 37 years old? He looks like Rasputin after a night out. I mean, he really does not look good. His
job has clearly taken its toll, hasn't it? The poor fellow.
Well, absolutely. And so he put this social... Ben Gummer, who's tipped to replace Jeremy Hunt at Health, possibly, was largely in charge of drafting the manifesto. And that's usually the case. It's usually one or two people that draft the manifesto, and then in Labour's case they have a clause five meeting where everyone piles in, and in this case it was obviously circulated around the top bods of the Tory massive, and Fiona Hill and I think the chair, Patrick McLaughlin, I think the chair of the Tory party, both were anti the social care thing and wanted it taken out, because it was Nick Timothy that put it in. He put it in at the last minute, and they wanted it taken out, and they went to Theresa May, and basically Theresa May overruled and said it was to be kept in. There's this kind of, it's the inability to take criticism that I think is ultimately going to be her undoing. This worrying rhetoric we had about dissent in Parliament. Do you remember when she called the general election because she, you know, said there was dissent?
Yes.
She seems to see democracy as dissent, and obviously that clearly, if that's your attitude, that colours every part of your thinking, doesn't it? So it would seem that anybody that does not want to do what she wants to do is wrong, and there is no listening to it. And to me, actually looking back on it, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing. The first sign of trouble, the first sign that things weren't going to be well, was when Katy Perry, the press officer, the head of press, head of communications, left the day after the general election was called suddenly because she had apparently fallen out with Fiona Hill. And she was, there was a really interesting interview with her in the Times a day or two ago, and she said the big problem with the social care manifesto thing was that if you're going to have a change that large, you need to be briefing what I suppose are trendily called stakeholders. So, you know, people in the sector, other MPs, you know, as much as I hate Jeremy Hunt, the Secretary of State for the Department of Health should not be being told what's going to be put in the manifesto about social care a few hours before it goes in. That's just nuts. Katy Perry says that not only should that have been handled much better, but she claims their internal polling said from the very beginning that they were only likely to end up with a 50-seat majority. And her view was that should have been leaked earlier on, and there should have been far more done to manage expectation management, because now we're in a position where virtually any way in which Theresa May wins, she still loses, if you see what I mean. Because there was talk of, you know, 150, 200. It has to be said, credit where it's due. And I think our predictions might end up being right, weirdly. We predicted 50 and 68 for majority. And you said that you thought Mr. Corbyn might surprise a few people. And he has. He's had a good campaign. He's done, you know, because he's had his, you know, negative moments. He got completely monstered on Women's Hour, for instance. But having said that, he's been made to look better by her, I think, because she won't answer questions. She won't, even when she's there to answer questions, which is increasingly rare, she won't answer a straight question. Someone asked me what I wanted to eat at the Mexican last night, and I said, I think it's very important that we recognise that Mexican food does exist and that lots of people like it, both in Mexico and beyond. And I believe that I am the strong and stable choice to deliver the best Mexican food that we can. So I love answering questions at the start of Theresa May. Have a great time. So she, you know, And on the opposite side, he is turning up and answering questions and turning up to debates. And actually talking about the debates, it was when he said he was going to go. And in a way, this is why Corbyn is so infuriating. He was almost impossible to fight because he doesn't play by normal rules. Most people would go, oh, I can't go, I haven't prepared. And Corbyn would just go, oh, I'll go and wing it. And turned up. And the minute that he said he was going to turn up, I think she should have turned up too. And certainly not Swell. And actually, as regular listeners know, I am no fan of Amber Rudd. But the whole situation highlighted Theresa May, I think, limitations as a manager as well. Because managing is about human skills as much as it is technical skills. Reportedly, Amber Rudd's 93-year-old father died 48 hours before she stood in for Theresa May at the debate. I suspect what happened was Amber Rudd probably said, no, I'm fine. I can do this. I want to focus on work, which is, you know, a perfectly plausible reaction. I probably would have done the same. What Theresa May, as a grown-up manager, should have done, if I'd been managing, I would have either gone, no, I don't think you should go. It's not right. I'll go. Or she should have sent someone else instead. And in a way, that reflects how much she's done to alienate or sideline most of her cabinet, that they are really struggling to find people to put out. They've made it all about her, and now she's starting to falter. They seem to have boxed themselves in for other options.
Yeah, I mean, Mrs. May has run a rotten campaign. It's just been crap, hasn't it, really?
And they're panicking, I think, now as well.
But perhaps, you know, we never know. Those secret Tory voters will quietly give her that majority. On the other hand, I really do genuinely feel that Mr. Corbyn has seemed increasingly likable as the weeks have gone by.
Yeah,
but
absolutely, of course,
people walking into the polling stations at the last minute may think about Diane Abbott as Home Secretary and shudder and vote elsewhere. This is what we don't know, that those two variables with Mrs. May having run the rotten campaign, has that shed away her support in the marginal seats, which are, of course, the important ones? There's no worry if she's lost a few votes in Maidenhead, just as there's no point Mr. Corbyn piling on votes in Islington. That doesn't make a difference. But I think one of the most remarkable twists in the 6 weeks of the campaign has been the sight of Theresa May transform before our eyes from the Daily Mail's depiction of a, as you said, I think, as a latter-day Thatcher, a 21st century Iron Lady, to a nervous, edgy, yes, rather terrified-looking character. And I think far from convincing us that she's too busy touring the country, it's increasingly probable that she avoided the television debate or debates simply because she knew she would struggle and she was simply scared.
Absolutely, and I agree. And I think I said at the beginning that she was probably right to swerve the debates because I suspected that she wasn't probably going to be very good at them. Mm. And you know, and that she, her problem is she can't think on her feet. She's a technocrat, mm, and that is who she is. And I'm not criticizing her. Funnily enough, although Yvette Cooper always gets a wanging for being a technocrat, she's far easier at doing that sort of thing. And I was talking to someone on the phone yesterday who's a person that works for one of the unions, and we were sort of talking, and she said, well, in my opinion, this shows what happens when you put someone in charge who has never really been a frontline campaigner person. And it's true. I mean, you know, although Theresa May was Home Secretary and was high profile, she never used to go on telly that much to defend, you know, to go out for Cameron. She wasn't like Osborne or Johnson or Amber Rudd or Jeremy Hunt or people that we used to see on the, or you know, Michael Green or whatever is, whatever that bloke's name was, Grant Shapps, the guy with the many manes, you know, people that kind of turned up on telly, Michael Gove, you know, all the old Nicky Morgan, all the old gang that used to turn up and do media appearances and things. She was never really one of them. She campaigned quietly for Remain. That is that one photograph of her by a street stall, and she gave a speech to Goldman Sachs, and that's pretty much all she did. She clearly isn't someone that is that popular. Her appeal was always that she was a grafter and she got it done. Mm. And that was how they tried to sell her. And so obviously that it was a mistake to try and then run it as a presidential election, because I don't think that is her.
I think one last quick thought on the unease of Mrs. May in the spotlight, yeah, yeah, is that for her, and you mentioned it, it's relatively new, her being in the spotlight with such a degree of intensity, whereas Mr. Corbyn is merely saying what he's been saying in public,
yeah,
in debating chambers for 40 plus years.
Absolutely.
So he's very much at ease in this situation, whereas she clearly isn't. OK, next up, other televised sports find ex-players who provide insight and expertise. Why does football have such a problem with co-commentators? That's next after Television Personalities.
Walking down the King's Road, I see so many faces. So many faces. They come from many places. They come down for the night. They walk around together and try and look trendy. I think it's a shame that they all look the same. Here they come. La 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 la. La 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 la. The part-time punks. La 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 la. La 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 la. The part-time punks. Then they go to Archive to buy Susie and the Banshees. They heard John Peel play it just the other night. They like to buy the O-level single. I read about Seymour. They're not dressed in red, so they buy the lurkers instead. Here they come. La 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 la. La 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 la. The part-time punks. Here they come. La 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 la. Go in the bedroom, you fly to the mirror,
from their excellent 1978 EP, Where's Bill Grundy Now?
Indeed, that's a fair question. It is owned by me as well. As a teenager, I bought that because I was having a teenage punk time, even if nobody else was by that point.
And that's Television Personalities and Part-Time Punks. There's a good-hearted swipe at the young people from the suburbs who put on their bondage trousers on a Saturday lunchtime, walked up and down the King's Road for an hour or two posing for tourists and Daily Express photographers before going back to their mum and dad's house in Twickenham for their tea.
Well, that was pretty much me in Hastings. But yes, I still enjoyed the record because when you're young, you have no sense of people being ironic about you.
Actually led me to think, excuse me, when I picked this, that the only youth movement since the 1950s that wasn't a part-time venture was the Woodstock generation of hippies.
Yes, who really, I suppose so.
They really did seem to live the sort of turn-on and drop-out lifestyle. All the other whimsies, mods, rockers, punks, rave, all their members remained within society. And running jobs, going to school and conforming, basically.
Absolutely. Although, having said that, yes, good on the hippies for leading their lifestyle right up until they all started running their hedge funds and advertising accounts.
Absolutely, yes. And owning Virgin Records and therefore picking up islands in the Caribbean.
Yes. Well, it's the private healthcare ownership I have more of an issue with. But anyway, let's move on.
When you watch sport on the TV, and I think particularly with cricket, listen to the coverage on the radio, it's remarkable how some sports have found absolutely ideal examples of former professional players from those sports who've made the transition to broadcasting. And they bring a sort of sense of clarity and knowledge to viewers and listeners. Cricket is going through a golden age on the radio with Geoffrey Boycott, Vic Marks, and in particular, and most unlikely in many ways, Phil Tufnell.
Absolutely, yes, he's great.
He's great. He brings humour as well as insight to the listeners. In golf, Nick Faldo and Ken Brown, former professionals, are articulate, knowledgeable, and add a depth of understanding. It enhances our experience of watching a golf tournament. Tennis coverage has the shrewd and sharp, sometimes acerbic John McEnroe. Plenty of examples in other sports. Football, however, oh dear, really, because anyone watching the FA Cup final on the BBC last weekend would have heard former player Danny Murphy as a co-commentator. Now, he seems a pleasant fellow. He can stick one word in front of another. But he spent the whole game moaning and criticising as if he was a son of Mark Lawrenson. And the process of co-commentating seemed like an ordeal, like he'd been dragged there against his will. And he managed to extinguish any sense of joy from the game. Why can't football find a Phil Tufnell or a Mick Fitzgerald, Jules?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? And I wonder if, and I could be completely wrong here, but I wonder if it might be a question of ego and money conflating together. So we've got a situation where, although the pecuniary rewards in other sports are greater than they once were, they're all dwarfed by football, whose rewards have risen and grown higher and quicker than anyone else's rewards. The money sloshing around in football is ridiculous. And I think the problem at the moment is they're trying to bring in co-commentators who, rightly so, a new generation of co-commentators. So footballers that have played very recently, who have more than I think the older generation been paid these mental wages and been treated like, I mean, footballers really are seen as film stars now. I was watching the excellent film The Damned United the other day. Again, it's one of my favourite films. If you haven't seen it, Michael Sheen as Brian Clough is superb. Yeah. It's a great film. I'm not usually a DVD extra person because I don't usually have the time, but as I was doing some ironing, because I am that exciting, I thought I'd start watching the extras. And they had this little kind of mini documentary about how footballers are different now as they were then, and I think we talked previously about how detached footballers are from lifestyles now, and how they don't, you know, the Leeds players from the 70s were talking about going to the pub with the players afterwards, yeah, but with the fans afterwards. And so you've got this situation where footballers are film stars and rock stars now, and they're very remote and they're very, very rich and they're very disconnected. And there's nothing like being very rich and disconnected from normal life and having wall-to-wall coverage of yourself on television playing football to overinflate one's sense of importance. And I think that if you are co-commentating, it's like co-presenting radio shows. I remember when I first started presenting for ARFM, and the guy that ran it said to me, have you ever presented a joint show before? And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, it's really hard. And I said, why is it really hard? And he said, because if you're used to presenting shows by yourself, you're just used to it being you and you wanted to talk and the whole thing being centered around you talking and you being the most important. And it's a bit of a reality check when there is someone else that is trying to be as important as you. Mm-hmm. And I think when you've got a co-commentator, and if you are a footballer and you're used to people singing your name and being paid a great big stack of money and, you know, private jets everywhere and it all being very, very cool to and very much about you, even though you play in a team, to some extent it is about you. If you are then having to co-commentate with someone else, and ultimately where you've got someone like the thing that Mark Chapman does on Match of the Day, is it Match of the Day 2? I can't remember what it's called. The thing that's on Sunday lunchtimes. And when you've got, you know, footballers on that, they tend mostly to have journalists now, tellingly. They have people like Amy Lawrence, who is excellent, but and people, Oliver Holt from The Times and various people. But when you are having to co-commentate next to someone and you've got the lead commentator, and when they have commentators of football matches, they always have a lead, like Clive Tilsley or Jonathan Pearce or someone, and then you have, you know, Danny Mills or whoever sitting, or who is quite good actually, sitting along for the ride. It's to be fair to them, it's difficult to know to what extent you should talk and to what extent you should shut up. But if you have been a kind of an ego-driven, highly paid football player, it's probably quite affronting that it's not all about you, which is why we have people like Robbie Savage being so horrendous, I think. I think that's a prime example of a footballer who was all right as a footballer. I don't think he was particularly great, but, you know, he was good at what he found a niche and he was good at what he did, and is a huge attention seeker, went on Strictly Come Dancing. If I had to predict that any footballer would end up sprayed with orange and covered in rhinestones, it would have been him, and it was him. And he is really poor as a co-commentator, I think, because he's used to being in the spotlight, and having to share that is an unenjoyable experience.
I've wondered if football coverage would be better without an ex-player beside the professional commentator. It actually detracts from our enjoyment to hear Robbie Savage with his, you know, verbal tick, and also to hear Glenn Hoddle mangle the language and reach. he reaches for words constantly. He's reaching for words just out of his grasp. It's excruciating. And
I mean, there are some that are really good and insightful. Well, I think they keep it going. I think they keep the idea. I mean, the Martin Keown's, Gary Neville,
you Phil know, Neville now is very good. Alan Shearer
used to be awful. Still out on Phil Neville.
Well, you see, the thing is, this is my point. Some people are hapless and hopeless, and they keep picking them. Some people are very good, and they should cherish them, like Gary Neville. Yeah. And I think why I put Phil Neville into the keep category is I look at Alan Shearer as the model for this, because Alan Shearer used to be hopeless. He used to sit on the fence. He used to want to not upset his golf mates.
Powers.
Somebody in over one summer, about 3 or 4 years ago, presumably a producer, maybe his management, his agent, I don't know, said, look, come on, we're going to lose this gig unless you really just be yourself, relax, and let your normal words flow. And they did. Phil Neville had, he would be the first to say it, horrendous baptism of fire as a co-commentator.
Oh, yes,
he
was
awful.
Terrible.
And I think he knew it. But whether they put him on a training course, whether some people had a word with him, that he had a lot more practice at it, but now he's developed, because he is an intelligent man, and that's the key.
Both the Nevilles are.
But I
like Neville and Carragher as a combination. I don't often watch Monday Night Football, but I do try to if I am somewhere, because I like them a lot.
My problem is why they continue with the Savages and the Hoddles, and in this season on BT Sport, I know you don't have BT Sport, but I do, actually. Oh, you do? Sorry, it's the Sky you don't have, isn't it?
Yeah.
On BT Sport, Owen Hargreaves, with his peculiar habit of saying words in three, groups each sentence. How do they keep their jobs despite universal wincing, particularly on social media. It's a mystery that only Owen Hargreaves can explain.
Absolutely, yes. And I also can't believe that Michael Owen continues to have any sort of public career. I completely agree. It is mystifying. And actually, I think we've talked previously about whether they would be better off getting more football writers involved. And the Sunday lunchtime thing on BBC is excellent. I really like it. I like the fact they've still got the football focus, or as my parents insist on calling it, football foci, the kind of magazine programme on a Saturday. But I really like the Sunday lunchtime thing where they get some broadsheet writers on or male writers or whatever, and get them to kind of discuss things. And in a way, that's really good. And I wonder if there should be more of an emphasis on that than, you know, he did great, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, there are some footballers. I mean, I do like Martin Keogh, and there are some. And like you say, Shearer's improved exponentially. And I do think if you have two, the idea that those that can do, those that can't teach. I think if you have too many people that have never actually played, I think you do lose those insights. And actually, it goes to show that, you know, that Phil Tufnell it has played, but it's still very insightful. So I think it can be done. Maybe it's just the idea. I almost feel terrible bringing this up, but when we talked about golf and cricket and them having excellent articulate commentators, I wonder if this is a class thing to some extent as well, and an education thing.
Education, certainly.
And actually, I think that class and education are very bound up. So I think that I feel that those two things, if you look at the amount of cricketers that went to public school and perhaps golfers as well, golf is a sport that is not inexpensive to play because you have to have all the gear, don't you? I think that there's possibly an education class dimension to this, and I hope that we don't lose those insights. But like I say, I think that the combination of class education and also this idea of money and ego and the way that football is driven, and I think that in a way everyone else ends up, perhaps producers as well, end up accidentally buying into that, and maybe they feel that, oh well, we couldn't possibly sack Robbie said, maybe also as well, speaking as an increasingly weary feminist on this issue, you know, he's a lad, Robbie, isn't he? Oh, he's good fun to have around in the studio, and it's amazing to what extent, and I say this rather bitterly, men can get away with being rubbish, whereas women can't, because men get on and they're all lads and hooray for them, really. So yeah, sorry to be so negative in conclusion, but well, that's where we are. I
just think it's ludicrous that we've got into this situation where we believe, or it's the broadcasters believe, I should say, that you have to be an ex-player to commentate. And what I really do believe, there's plenty of scope for journalists, people who can speak, people from the outside. And I say this because in order for her to talk about the 16th century, Lucy Worsley didn't have to live in Tudor times to be an
expert. Absolutely not, yeah.
And equally, Monty Don hasn't had to have led an earlier life as a plant to be able to become an expert gardener. So to say that you actually had to be there to be knowledgeable and articulate about commenting on something is just simply ludicrous. So they need to get over that and either employ more people who can actually speak and who have enthusiasm and don't treat the whole thing as a misery festival, or simply just don't have people at all in football, just have the commentator.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, if you're going to get people, make them good, I suppose.
Exactly. My internet at home went down for about 30 seconds earlier this week, and I nearly collapsed with instant stress.
I mean, I have to say, as someone that spends a lot of their life attached to a phone, even I find this excessive. So I'm looking forward to giving you some real talk about this.
You don't have to be ancient to remember a time when we could just cut ourselves off and relax. That's next after Lauren Laverne.
You can't.
And I have to say, it's a pleasure to hear that again. And it also reminds me of my part-time punk years and when I was first getting into music and buying the TV Personalities EP from a junk shop in Hastings. I was a fervent reader of the music press then. I think we've talked at length previously about the decline of the music press and what that means. I used to read Enemy and Select and The Melody Maker. I used to read a lot. I still remember the heartbreak when I opened the Christmas issue and a printed A5 flyer fell out that said this is the last issue of the Melody Maker, and everyone went what, and they used to have excellent cover mounts, and I believe that it was either a Melody Maker or an Enemy cover mount that had this song on it by Lauren Laverne. It was from her EP. She just after leaving Kinnickies, she was starting to do a bit of TV presenting and a bit of radio stuff for XFM. She wasn't the kind of big media figure she is now, but she I think had a bit of a tilt at a solo career to test the waters, and she had an EP called Take These Flowers Away. She sang with Mint Royale on Don't Fault It, but this came from this EP, sorry, and it was called If You Phone, and I love it because it's a throwback to a bygone age, and we didn't have mobile phones to be glued to, and you often waited in for a call for someone on your landline.
Well, this is the relevance to this our last topic, because a long time ago when I was at school, I can remember...
Yes,
a long, long time ago. I can still remember a classmate who was very keen on chess, and he would bring a miniature set to school and would take on his mate at chess games during the lunch break. Nothing unusual there. But also, and this didn't seem odd at the time, yet in today's world seems prehistoric, this chess fellow, he used to take part in a chess game with what used to be called a pen pal in Germany by postcard. And what one would decide on their next move in this chess game, would jot it down on a postcard, mail it to the other country. I'm guessing it would have taken a week or so. The other one would decide their next move and then would send a postcard back. So I'm guessing a game would have taken a year or more to complete. And you must have needed such patience and commitment to wait.
Absolutely,
the best part of a week to find out what your opponent's move is going to be. Now, contrast this with the heebie-jeebies that I felt this week. My internet went down at home, and immediately my heart sank, and I began to think of all the things I couldn't do, the horror.
What I like about you, you remain a positive person at all times.
That's right, yeah. I was thinking of the energy sapping calls to Virgin Media and all the press, one for sales, two for mobile phone inquiries, three to upgrade your broadband. But then, after about 30 seconds, it came back. And what I noticed was I had a kind of wave of relief sweeping over me. It was a sort of ocean of serotonin whooshed through my brain. And, I could return, to my toast, as it happened, with new fortitude. And you're youngish, Jules.
Allegedly, yeah.
Even you must remember days before we were so connected. You mentioned it there about waiting at home for a landline call. I can remember before we even had a landline at my childhood home. And when we were all so tied to our communication devices and so wedded to needing internet everywhere we go.
Absolutely, yeah. And I've got a couple of stories actually from this era. So I remember the pre-mobile phone era. I started to use the internet on computers at school. It would have been around, Microsoft 98, the Windows 98 thing. That really kind of changed things. The internet was sort of working. So that in 1998, this is going to depress everyone, I'm sorry, but in 98 to 2000, I was in the 14 to 16 bracket. So I was starting to use the internet as a teenager. I get very Proustian rushes if I ever see old GeoCities sites on the internet.
Yes.
Yeah, I used to live my life by those, mostly Kinnicky and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and in Elastica 4, and that was my world. So I used to use the internet at home. We had a dial-up connection. So as they say, only 90s kids will remember, please can you get off the phone? I want to use the internet. You plug out the phone cable and plug it into the modem, and then you dial up and you'd have that lovely noise.
Screeching noise.
Beep, boo, 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 boo. Yeah, it was always in the same order as well. But so in the pre-mobile phone era, I used to go to the South of England show, which is at the county showground in Ardingly in East Sussex. Mm. I think it's East Sussex. And every year they have, we just refer to it as Ardingly now. And it's usually, it's probably next weekend actually. It's usually around this time in June. Mm. And it's 3 days. I remember when I worked for a very hunting, shooting, fishing law firm, one year my family all got badges and we could go in and go in the enclosure. That was very exciting. But basically it's a kind of a curious mix of agricultural shows. I mean, it's far less agriculture than it used to be. My granny used to be a sheep and a pig judge and a cattle judge. So there's quite a lot of judging of animals that goes on. And there's a big showground where they have show jumping, and there's a big arena where they have show jumping. There are also loads of stalls, both public sector stalls and kind of marketing type stalls. And it, because it's so large, it's in a block system, and each block has a number, and you get given a map at the beginning of the day in the program, and then you try and find people. And one year I went with my mum and my dad and my granddad. It was after my granny had died, and my mum, we agreed with my dad and my granddad that they were going to go off to look at some cattle, I think, and we would meet them at a certain place. And we turned up and they weren't there, and this was a pre-mobile phone era, and basically we lost the whole afternoon because we couldn't find them, and we kept walking around. It was a big place. And I remember saying to my mum once, my dad was complaining about mobile phones and saying, "You're always on that blooming phone." And I remember my mum saying, "Look, if we'd had mobile phones and we were at Aldingly that year, that would have been sorted out in 4 minutes, probably, or 5 minutes. You bring someone, they would have said, 'Oh yeah, we're over here,' and then we would have found them." So in that sense, mobile phones and connectivity have made our lives a lot easier. In terms of not having mobile phones and social media, for example, again, this is a kind of a 98-era story. I went on a school trip, and we went off to Italy. It was the first time I'd been abroad properly at length, and we went on this trip to Rome in the Sorrento, and it was amazing. And we came back on Good Friday, and we landed at Luton Airport. You know, the glamour that is Luton Airport. Yeah, and it really was a shed in those days.
They ridiculously still refer to it as London Luton Airport.
Which I know.
Anybody coming from America for the first time thinking, "Hey, this doesn't... Where's the Houses of Parliament? This
absolutely
doesn't look like London."
It's just a sort of a cattle shed in the Midlands, really. But anyway, the staff there are always very nice, I must point out. But so we landed at Luton Airport. I didn't have a mobile phone, so not only did I have to call my mum on a payphone from Luton Airport, I know, I have always lived a deeply groundless life, Terence. Not only did I have to ring her to tell her that we got in, but she then said to me, because we didn't have Twitter or newscasts on our phones, she said, "Oh, by the way, the Good Friday Agreement's been signed. There's peace in Northern Ireland." And, you know, in my lifetime, I remember the Manchester bombing and, in the Almdale and Omar and, you know, really terrible things. And Oakland, you know, I know that the IRA weren't involved in Oklahoma, but, you know, I think there were, all that kind of stuff. I remember that happening. And for that to be peace in Northern Ireland, I remember getting onto the bus and telling people it had happened. And the driver tuned the radio and we listened to Five Live, I think, or something, on the drive back down to Sussex. But the idea that, you know, nowadays, of course, yeah, I should rein it in, really, but I'm constantly on Twitter or on the Guardian live blog seeing what's going on. And the idea that the only way in which I found out about the Good Friday Agreement was the fact that I rang my mum on a payphone from Luton Airport and she told me. And then, of course, when I got home, the other social media, the story that would have been all over social media now, I went on to teletext because we didn't have the internet at this point. So I went on to teletext to see what the news was and read the story about George Michael being caught soliciting in a public toilet. So, which of course now we know. Can you imagine how social media would have handled that story? And yet, you know, in a way, I'm kind of glad for him that I read it on a teletext page. So I'm amused at how completely different my experience of those news stories would have been now as to how they were then.
I wonder how we might react if suddenly the internet and even phone lines disappeared. And I was thinking about when that Icelandic volcano sent up some dust a few years ago.
Oh yes, they had the name that nobody can ever pronounce.
That's right. And all the European flights were halted. And after a day or two, there were no planes in the air at all. And after a day or two, I began to think, actually, this is all rather pleasant. And heresy, I even thought, would I really mind if aeroplanes ceased to be, you know, peace and quiet against the ability to get places really quickly? I know. But, you know, I think I've mentioned it before. I'm not sure whether I've said it on the podcast or not, but I really do enjoy probably at least once a week going for a relatively longish, couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, stroll in the Surrey Hills. And it's lovely. It's a very underrated area. And sometimes by the River Wey, just quite remote places where you can just get away from people for a while. But the one thing you can't get away from, because if you're in the Surrey Hills, you're close to Gatwick Airport, the one thing you can't get away from, and Heathrow indeed, you can't get away. You think, oh, it's lovely. Listen, just the birds singing and the wind whistling through those rushes by the side of the River Wey, and then a blooming 747 comes hurtling over and you think, oh no. So of course we see it as going backwards, and we can never uninvent things when they exist, otherwise someone would have uninvented Nigel Farage by now. But sometimes, though, you know, just an unconnected, simpler world seems a more attractive place to be.
Absolutely. Despite your panic attack about your internet, yes, I'm inclined to agree. And actually, speaking of kind of the idea that I suppose the point I was making, that things are very different now to how they were then. Oh, that's great. My phone's just gone off to interrupt us talking. Isn't that ironic? So I was been recently rewatching
the whole thing encapsulated in
Absolutely.
3 seconds.
In one bong of a text message. So I've been rewatching Life on Mars recently. For people that haven't seen it, it was on about 10 or 11 years ago. I've got the DVD stuff, the box sets. That's the phrase I'm looking for. I'm too embarrassed to say because it makes me sound like a hipster. But I have the box sets. And it was a drama that was on BBC in about 2005, 2006. And the idea was that it was about a policeman that was knocked over by a car and woke up and thought he was living in 1973. And the whole kind of premise of the show is based around, there's a lot of humour had around the fact that he keeps thinking there's going to be things in 1973 when they're on. And he says to the police officer that finds him when he's been knocked over, where's my mobile? I just need to get my mobile. And the police officer says, mobile what? And I love the idea that he rings a telephone exchange to try and contact his girlfriend on her mobile phone, and he starts to read the number. He says 077, and the woman on the telephone exchange says, "Is that an international number?" So it just goes to show how far we've moved, I think, really.
Of course, without connectivity, we wouldn't be able to see or hear you in your public appearances this week.
And that would truly be taking us back into the dark ages. Yes, I'm not DJing out. I am doing the Saturday Social evening.
Good.
On Barricade Radio from 6 to 7 PM. I'm not sure what year I'm doing this week. We might go very late '60s. I'm not sure. But anyway, 6 to 7 PM, Northern Soul, Motown and Mod, etc. BarricadeRadio.com. And I hope to be back with Indie Wonderland next week. Which is 8 to 10 PM, BarricadeRadio.com on Wednesday. I was hoping to go to see St Etienne next week, but I found out yesterday it has been postponed until December. Which is a great pity.
Because we had that down as you reviewing St Etienne.
Yes,
so
we did,
all off.
And unfortunately I can't. Although perhaps I could belatedly review the Nuns and the Silver Apples next week. But anyway, so those are my public business. And advanced trailing next Friday, so Friday the 9th of June. Depending on the nature of the election results, I will be doing my Rip It Up and Start Again, or rather just Rip It Up night at, we might be ripping it up and starting again, who knows, at the Palace in Hastings, on Hastings Seafront. And so it will either be, wild scenes of celebration, or perhaps, you know, some records to cheer us all up. Either, depending on your views as well. I tend to hang out, I've increasingly discovered, in very wildly left-wing circles, although people are now saying to me, I know you're not a fan of Corbyn, but, so I think that word has got around that I'm not, you know, not necessarily worldly pro. But anyway, that's my jetting about for this week.
Thanks to our super connected executive producer, Rona. And when we are back next week, it will be with our election or post-election special. So
absolutely, which will probably be a bit later, because I am working in committee rooms and at polling stations all day on Thursday, and I will be in bed all day on Friday because I am planning to stay up all night and watch it.
Yeah,
so I might
too.
Be able to give nerdy amounts of
sometime over next weekend. So we're going out with a red hot Northern Soul classic.
Absolutely, and there is there have been sort of two versions of it that are known, really. Dusty Springfield did a version of this, and there's a we're going to play the version by Susan Barrett. Apparently, Barbara Acklin did a version as well, so I think everyone's kind of had a go at it. There's a difficulty in knowing which one came first, which version was done first, Dusty or Susan Barrett, but. The jury stood out on this, but Jerry Ragavoy produced Dusty's recording of his own song. So it seems to be fair to assume that he gave the song to Dusty first, because presumably he wouldn't have authorised Susan Barrett to have her version first. But anyway, whoever sings it, it is an excellent song. So this is Susan Barrett, originally released on RCA in 1967, and this is What's It Gonna Be?
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.